Chapter 30. This episode burst Morris's life to pieces. Interpreting it by the past, he mistook Dickie for a second Clive, but 3 years are not lived in a day, and the fires died down as quickly as they had risen, leaving some suspicious ashes behind them. Dickie left on the Monday, and by Friday his image had faded. A client then came into the office, a lively and handsome young Frenchman, who implored Monsieur Orle not to swindle him. While they chaffed, a familiar feeling arose, but this time he smelt attendant odours from the abyss.
"Nope, people like me must keep our noses to the grindstone, I'm afraid," he replied, in answer to the Frenchman's prayer to lunch with him, and his voice was so British that it produced shouts of laughter and a pantomime. When the fellow had gone, he faced the truth. His feeling for Dickie required a very primitive name. He would have sentimentalised once and called it adoration, but the habit of honesty had grown strong. What a stoat he had been. Poor little Dickie. He saw the boy leaping from his embrace to smash through the window and break his limbs, or yelling like a maniac until help came. He saw the police. Lust. He said the word out loud. Lust is negligible when absent. In the calm of his office, Morris expected to subdue it now that he had found its name. His mind, ever practical, wasted no time in theological despair, but advanced to the grindstone. He had been forewarned, and therefore forearmed, and had only to keep away from boys and young men to ensure success. Yes, from other young men. Certain obscurities of the last 6 months became clear. For example, a pupil at the settlement, he wrinkled his nose as one who needs no further proof. The feeling that can impel a gentleman towards a person of lower class stands self-condemned. He did not know what lay ahead. He was entering into a state that would only end with impotence or death. Clive had postponed it. Clive had influenced him, as always. It had been understood between them that their love, though including the body, should not gratify it, and the understanding had proceeded. No words were used from Clive. He had been nearest to words on the first evening at Penge, when he refused Morris's kiss, or on the last afternoon there, when they lay amid deep fern. Then had been framed the rule that brought the golden age, and would have sufficed till death. But to Morris, despite his content, there had been something hypnotic about it. It had expressed Clive, not him. But now that he was alone, he cracked hideously, as once at school. And it was not Clive who would heal him. That influence, even if exerted, would have failed, for a relation such as theirs cannot break without transforming both men forever. But he could not realize all this. The ethereal past had blinded him, and the highest happiness he could dream was a return to it. As he sat in his office working, he could not see the vast curve of his life, still less the ghost of his father sitting opposite. Mr. Hall Sr. had neither fought nor thought. There had never been any occasion. He had supported society and moved without a crisis from illicit to licit love. Now, looking across at his son, he is touched with envy, the only pain that survives in the world of shades. For he sees the flesh educating the spirit, as his has never been educated, and developing the sluggish heart and the slack mind against their will. Presently Morris was called to the telephone. He raised it to his ear, and after 6 months' silence heard the voice of his only friend. "Hello," he began.
"Hello. You'll have heard my news, Morris."
"Yes, but you didn't write, so I didn't."
"Quite so."
"Where are you now?"
"Off to a restaurant. We want you to come round there. Will you?"
"I'm afraid I can't. I've just refused one invitation to lunch."
"Are you too busy to talk a little?"
"Oh, no." Clive resumed, evidently relieved by the atmosphere.
"My young woman's with me. Presently she'll talk, too."
"Oh, all right. Tell me all your plans."
"The wedding's next month."
"Best of luck." Neither could think of anything to say.
"Now for Anne." "I'm Anne Woods,"
said a girl's voice. "My name's Hall."
"What?"
"Morris Christopher Hall."
"Mine's Anne Claire Wilbraham Woods, but I can't think of anything to say."
"No more can I."
"You're the eighth friend of Clive I've talked to in this way this morning."
"The eighth?"
"I can't hear."
"I said the eighth."
"Oh, yes. Now I'll give Clive a turn. Goodbye.
Clive resumed.
By the way, can you come down to Penge next week? It's short notice, but later all will be chaos.
I'm afraid I can't do that very well. Mr. Hill's getting married too, so that I'm more or less busy here.
What, your old partner?
Yes, and after him, Ada, to Chapman.
So I heard. How about August?
Not September, that's almost certainly the by-election.
But come in August, and see us through that awful Park v. Village cricket match.
Thanks, I probably could. You'd better write nearer the time.
Oh, of course. By the way, Anne has £100 in her pocket. Will you invest it for her?
Certainly. What does she fancy?
You'd better choose. She's not allowed to fancy more than 4%.
Morris quoted a few securities.
I'd like the last one, said Anne's voice. I didn't catch its name.
You'll see it on the contract note. What's your address, please? She informed him. All right. Send the check when you hear from us. Perhaps I'd better ring off and buy at once. He did so. Their intercourse was to run on these lines. However pleasant Clive and his wife were to him, he always felt that they stood at the other end of the telephone wire. After lunch, he chose their wedding present. His instinct was to give a thumper, but since he was only 8th on the list of the bridegroom's friends, this would seem out of place. While paying 3 guineas, he caught sight of himself in the glass behind the counter. What a solid young citizen he looked, quiet, honourable, prosperous without vulgarity. On such does England rely. Was it conceivable that on Sunday last he had nearly assaulted a boy?